Hey, it's Eric G. Around the House is sponsored by Baldwin Hardware. For 75 years, Baldwin Hardware has been known for its first-class quality and craftsmanship in door and cabinetry hardware. As an alumnus of the Baldwin Hardware Design Council, I can say I have seen the details and quality from design to the finished product. If you're looking for a new style and old-world craftsmanship, I can tell you there is only one Baldwin Hardware. Check out what would look great in your home at baldwinhardware.com.
When it comes to remodeling and renovating your home, there is no better show on your radio. This is Around the House with Eric G.
Everybody stop what you're doing, please!
From your back fence to the sidewalk, Eric will tell you how to keep it all in tip-top shape while helping you save a buck while doing it. If you like DIY projects, it takes a lot of practice to get good at it, and Eric is here to guide the way.
These are the wrong plans! These are the old plans!
All that and more on the fastest 2 hours of home improvement radio.
Stop it! Stop what you're doing!
Welcome to Around the House with Eric G.
Welcome to Around the House with Eric G. This is where we talk home improvement every weekend. Thanks for joining us. You know, this is a special episode because I've got my good friend David Applebaum, Architect of the Stars, here. Welcome, brother, to Around the House again.
Eric, always a blast to talk to you. People don't realize that Eric and I actually talk constantly with silly messages or conversations about things that come up in our lives. Like, can you believe?
I've been to your house. Yes. This is not just a radio interview. This is two friends having a good time on the radio and a podcast talking about stuff that we love to do.
Yeah, and I need to get to your house, but I know that as soon as I do, you're going to put a tool belt on me and put me to work, which is fine. I like working. And I love actually getting my hands dirty in that way. You know I do.
You know that, but I would give you a drafting pencil and a drafting board and go, now what about this elevation, David?
Yeah, but see, the thing that would be great about doing something like that with you is we might do a couple of mock-ups. So, because yep. I'm very three-dimensional. And the stuff that I do doesn't always show as well on paper. So it's always good. That's why I build a model for every design that I do, because first of all, I've found I cannot explain to the client why my idea is good if they don't have a chance to actually see it. Because if things aren't the way they're used to, they can get very uncomfortable. I have a story about a client a long time ago. I came, this is actually, now that I think about it, this was maybe the most empowering thing that ever happened to me in my life. I had just started my practice. I was driving a Blazer four-wheel drive SUV before they were popular.
Nice.
It was actually a truck that had the shell on the back because I skied pretty much every weekend back then. Single, no kids, a lot easier. And this client, this potential client, had seen saw the model of this house that I had done, and or was about to do. And she said, oh, I love what is this? This is your house? How did he make your house look like this? I got to meet your architect. And so I showed up and she was not very friendly. And we walk inside. She's got this hillside house. So there were 9 levels in the house. You entered, you took 4 steps down to the living room and then 3 steps down to the kitchen, which meant typical remodeling, which would be to add another room, you couldn't do because the floor wasn't at the same level. The floor next to you was at eye level.
Totally get that. My house growing up had 7 levels. It was a nightmare to do
that. No, I didn't
know
that.
Yeah, we had 7 levels at my house growing up. It was a early 70s house. And my parents, I have 3 brothers, so we needed a big house for all the kids. 7 levels in this house for that same crazy reason. And I think that always scarred me a little bit as a designer.
Well, so I'm looking at how hard it is to do a remodeling, and I'm looking around, And she said, and she just kind of looks at me and says, well, I've had 9 other architects look at this. I've spent $20,000 on preliminary designs. Tell me what you've got that they haven't already told me. And I said, I think that your kitchen and your dining room are in the wrong places. And she looked at me like, are you an idiot? And she said, what? How could you say that? I said, well, your dining room is actually just a banquette facing the backyard. And your kitchen is 2 rooms, basically 2 C's intertwined with each other. So here's my thought. If we take the 2 rooms that are your kitchen and clean it up and make it into a nice formal dining room that overlooks the garden, we can then take what is this little abutment of a casual diner dining room. Let me go out into the garden next to the pool. So make an L shape around the pool. And, you know better than a lot of other people, and I think a lot of your listeners know, that new construction is less expensive than remodeling because you build a new foundation and new utilities. You don't have to tie in and work around other things.
Yep.
And I said, if we expand in this direction, then it's really inexpensive and we can give you glass on all 3 sides. You'll be in the middle of it was in a canyon. You can see the canyon on 2 sides and the pool on the other. And she looked at me and said, do you have a card? And I said, yes. So she took my card, went to a bulletin board. She pulled the pin out and threw out the 9 other architects' cards.
Nice.
And said, send me a contract. Nobody came up with something like that. And I was like, wow. And then she said, I want to have lunch with you after we sign the contract and explain something. And she sat me down and she said, you're driving the wrong car. I thought that you were a nail jockey that thought he knew how to draw. And I was so mean to you and I apologize. And until when you opened up your mouth, it's like, oh, that's a great idea. So, but in that, as I was, she wanted her son's room expanded because it was a little 7x8 little thing.
Tiny.
So the only way that I could add on to it was I started with 9 levels. I ended up with 12.
Yeah.
Because I had to do other half levels to fit in between. Mm-hmm. So he got a room that had 2 levels, and one became a play area and one became a bed area. And it was actually really interesting. And then next to it, we built a guest room. And I said, this is where you need to put your master bedroom. You're in a very dark half underground area. You should be here. It's a tree house. You had to put glass on 3 sides and surround you by trees. And it would be such a beautiful place to wake up every morning. He said, no, I'm happy where I'm at. When it was built, she looked at me and she said, you're right, I should have put the master bedroom here. It would have been so much nicer. I'm just so used to living in the same way. She said, you've got to get better. Now, I was only in my 20s.
Yep.
She said, you've got to get better at pushing people at things when they don't know. But you don't always know what you don't know, and that's why you hire an architect, because you can get really tunnel visioned on the way that you have lived or the way that you see it, and you might not see another way to skin a cat.
See, and that's the important part, and this is why I wanted to talk to you today, because, that's the thing that I look at with people, especially people that have been in that house for over 3 or 4 years, especially if they've been in there 10 or 15 or even longer. Because they have the habits, and those habits are hard to break. And those habits can really limit what the people have a hard time thinking outside of the box, visualizing. And when you say, no, your bedroom's going to be over here and this is going to be over here, people need to think of it as a new house, not just, oh, I'm moving things around inside my little world. It's hard to let go of how you do it now versus how it could be.
And it's funny because in some ways that's almost what I like best, is someone who's a little bit, I shouldn't say set in their ways, but someone who's been living in the house long enough to know what really doesn't work. Because then that can be the thing that I can glean and say, what is it that you hate about this house? What do you love about this house? So when I know those 2 things, I can then present something and say, remember that thing you hate? I can get rid of that by doing this. It's different, but don't you want to get rid of this aspect of the house?
Brilliant.
Some,
yep.
Sometimes, not always.
Oh no, I mean, I've had that. I've had that with, you know, trying to do a remodel on something where I'm designing something out, and oh, there's something they hate, but they don't want to go outside the box far enough to get rid of it.
Yeah,
and that's always that tough part to try to navigate that.
Yeah. It's kind of like finding a therapist. There's some therapists that will just pat you on the back and say, oh, you poor thing. Yes, you're a victim. Oh, my. And you don't really grow, but you are being placated in your situation. It's a lot harder to find somebody, and it's a lot more courageous to say, okay, what can I do to make my life better? And whether it be having more gratitude in your life and your therapist is teaching you how to do that, or whether you have gratitude because you wake up and everything is where you want it to be and it's lovely and it's comfortable and it feels like home. And I always say when I'm first meeting a client, I said, I really need to know what makes your life tick and what your lifestyle is, because I need to choreograph the spaces of this house to heighten what is your lifestyle. Some people wake up and they want to brush their teeth. Some people wake up and they have to go to the bathroom. Some people have to check on their kids. Some people want to go for a walk or a hike or a run or go to the gym, whichever is what you, and that's just starting your day. But every single one of those is a different house.
It absolutely is. And you know, that's the thing. You have worked with so many A-listers that we're not going to talk about all of them on the show by any means, but it's no different. What comes to mind by you telling that story is Frank Sinatra, when you were working on his place and how he loved to entertain, how he loved to make people comfortable. And that was many times based around the bar.
Many, all the time. All the time.
It's giving him some grace.
But you're right. Yeah. You find out what everybody's secret sauce is. People think, oh, how'd you come up with this? This is so great. And the answer is always, I did 753 stabs that were wrong. And 754 is the one that finally clicked. You just have to work at it. You have to find the secret sauce. And it's multi-dimensional. It's who the client is, what they need and what they want and what they can afford. Okay. Then it's what either the property and or the existing house is if you're remodeling.
Yep.
And then it's the lifestyle and getting all of those to mesh. I hear a lot of people say, oh, I don't need an architect. I've lived in a house all my life. I know exactly what I want. That's true. Okay. And you've been with your body all of your life. But if you have an interesting pain or you've got a blotch that shows up, don't you see a doctor?
Correct. Correct. You know, one of my funniest experiences as a designer is, like, you had the 754 stabs at it. I've had those 754 stabs at it. And one of the funniest things to me is when we end up on a decision on a plan and it was stab number one, because we just went completely full circle and I could pull out the drawing of my first iteration of that project and go, well, here it is right here. And they go, you already drew it up? And I go, oh, that was the first one we did.
How I have once walked in and said, oh, this is so clear. This goes here, that goes there, this goes there. And they said, oh, that makes sense. And there was one part that said, can you do that? I had a garage that was 28 feet from the house and there was dirt in between. Mm-hmm. And I just connected the two. And they were on different levels, but I was able to figure that. And I said, look, I want to expand this and do that. And that's been the easiest job I ever did, because I got it right the first time. But I've never had the joy that you've had of going back to, hey, this is what I did at first. My first stuff is always pretty bad. It really is. I keep the stack and go and kind of follow the rings and go back to where I started. Yep. And I'll look at those first designs. And that's when I really feel like I just, how did I get licensed?
Ah, come on. That's every architect and designer, though, that feels that way after those first ones, after you've gone through and done that. I just had one of those where we had virtually explored every single option, and we had been fully circle around the world and had looked at almost everything. And the contractor was laughing so hard because he was in the meetings with me, and they came back and sort of, well, I want to do this kitchen, this color with this, this way, with this door style, this color, this, everything else. I said, what do I want? And I just sat there in my head and went, I got to look at this real quick. And I just thumbed through my drawings and I'm like, got it right here.
Yeah, and that sounds familiar.
Yeah, exactly. And that was one of the reasons why I started years ago when I did drawings, I started numbering them like you're supposed to, but I actually numbered them.
Yeah.
You know, this is iteration 23 or, you know, 43. But
yeah, my AutoCAD files look different from any other offices I've ever seen because I start the design and I put the date on it and I have every single drawing on there.
Yep.
And then after like the first five or six stabs and it isn't working, I'll then put a new date on and erase the awful ones. That's where I'll go back and look.
Yep.
And then I'll just keep on going and keep on going and keep on going. And, you know, and then when I finally get what works, then you redate that one. That might be the ninth or 10th one that you do. And then that becomes the one that then has all of the working drawings and they're all there, including some of the old concepts. And they might have a star with a note next to it saying, the view works better here, but the flow doesn't.
Yep.
And so I'll come back to it. And then maybe sometimes you come back to something. Why didn't I think of that? I could put this here and now it works. And that's when you get the secret sauce. When here's what's funny. Those first stabs where it isn't working, it's just because I often relate it to a juggler that's got a tennis ball, a golf ball, a bowling ball, a flaming a bowling pin, and a spear.
Yep.
And, you know, we all start with one ball and then get comfortable with that, and then you throw in the second and the third and the fourth, and it takes a while to get the rhythm to get all of them going. You figure it out once you get enough of those objects in the juggling to go in the rhythm that now you can start putting everything together in a way that once it's so funny because it's so hard to get to that point. Mm-hmm. But once you get to that point, you could make a million different changes and they still all fit because now you know the secret code, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, and part of that is you're building the relationship between you and your client. So you're learning mm-hmm. to trust each other. You're learning how to communicate. You're learning what they can visualize and what they can't and what they're trying to tell you, but don't find the words to tell you.
Now, and if you have a good architect, they're also making sure that you can afford it. Because here's the thing that the most troubling thing about my profession right now is kind of twofold. And it has to do with the condition that the economy has been in over the last 20 years and so many dips in the real estate market that people weren't building.
Yep.
And architects started lowering their prices in order to get any commission.
Yep.
And that with now, at least in LA, and I'm sure it's that way in a lot of other places, there's so many, on one hand, amateur flippers that think this is a good way to make money. And then two, there are these unbelievable resources that there's about three companies here in Los Angeles and they're flipping all over the place. I don't know how they find the properties before they even go on the market. I don't know how they get, I know how they get their permits so fast, but we won't get into that. Mm-hmm. But all their projects look exactly the same and they have the same crew doing the same thing over and over and over again. And now in Los Angeles, it takes used to take a couple of months to get a permit. Now it takes nine mm-hmm. or more. If you're on a hillside or a substandard street, it could take a year and a half. And it's just them being really slow and bogged down and having 20 volumes of rules. And yep. So it's a lot harder to be an architect than it's ever been. But so many people started lowering their prices. That's now the standard. And I have hearing this now so often, the architect is paid so little, they just do a box or they rush through the drawings and the floor plan doesn't exactly match what the elevations have,
yep.
which don't exactly match the section. And so there are all these problems in construction that nobody really looked at closely enough. Now the builder has to fix it. And they call the architect for clarification, and he doesn't answer because he's too busy jamming those five other half-price projects that they're doing at the same time. And so, I mean, I just lost the job because my fee that I presented, which was 25% of my standard fee, but I liked the clients and I liked the site, was still double the price. And I, by the way, I didn't say 25% off.
Yeah.
It was 75% off and 25% of the fee. I was double the price of the person that ended up winning. And I know what's going to happen. I'm going to get phone calls. And I get phone calls from clients afterwards saying, oh, man, we told you that our budget was $1 million and you said that what we were doing was too much for $1 million and we needed $1.75 million to build it all. And we didn't believe you. We thought your stuff is so beautiful. You get what you pay for. We don't have to have it so pretty. We need to save money. So we saved $50,000 on an architect, and we're framed, and we're already at $1.5 million. And this thing will be at least $2 million when we're done. Mm-hmm. And we realize, I'll bet you could have done it for $1.75 million. And I don't know where we're going to come up with this extra money. And oh my, what do we do? What can you do?
Yeah, you're stuck. I mean, those are things that I have run into that it's interesting. And I can't tell you how many times I've done this just in my world of kitchen and bath design, where you look at the project and go, wow, for what you're asking for, this is going to be $140,000. And it's the same thing. You know, I know you want the Sub-Zero, you want the Wolf, you want all this stuff, but somebody else came in and told you they could do it for $65,000. And I'm looking at the appliances going, well, that's your appliance package.
Thank you.
You know, and then then it just doesn't make sense. And then halfway through the project, they fired people and they want to drag you back into it to do the job that you were going to do in the first place. And they still wonder why it's more, because now you have to undo all those bad mistakes that were done.
I won't even take those jobs.
Yeah.
I won't. It's kind of like, so, you know, you ask someone out and they go on a date and they say, you know what, you're too short. You don't make enough money. You don't have a nice enough car. And then a year later, they call you and say, you know what? You are the nicest guy I've met in the last 4 years. I think I need to drop that and come back to you. And it's like, you know what? If you had that thought at the beginning, you might have it again. How do I know that I can trust you to actually stick to your morals and virtues? And it's not really morals. That was wrong.
It isn't. I mean, when you go in and I just think that any of those things like that are just bad decisions. And, you know, when you get in the middle of this, those people that fight that battle of always looking for quality at the absolute cheapest price has gotten them where they are then. And you're still going to fight hard those tendencies trying to get the project finished because those bad decisions got them there. They didn't all of a sudden just wake up and say, I'm not making any more bad decisions. You're still having to fight that battle through the rest of the project, even when you're coming in playing superhero.
It's what kind of person are you? For instance, the most popular restaurant in all of the world, I think, is McDonald's. And excuse me, but it's a tasteless, nutritionless, fast way to eat. Well, I personally would rather, if I'm going to get a burger, I'd rather go to a mom and pop. I mean, my favorite place in LA, they hand grind their meat, and it's more expensive than In-N-Out, but it's always good. You can always count on it. And you come enough times, you know, everybody working there. That's the kind of life that I prefer to live. We live in a society that, especially since the pandemic, everybody's used to getting stuff from Amazon without even trying it on. And you don't know that sofa that you're buying from Amazon, you don't know how soft it is. You don't know exactly what the depth is and if it's going to fit your particular body. Okay. You don't know a lot of these things. I like to try things on and I like to do it what I think is the right way. It's certainly not the quick way. And it's not always the easiest way, but haven't you found that? I remember when my son was growing up, I would say to him, it's funny how often the easy way is the way that leads to disaster. And the one that takes just a little more work and a little more thought is the one that will get you farther in the long run. I don't think people look at the long run as much as they used to.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. One of my questions I had for you, David, was what's it like working through the Hollywood egos? And I'm not talking about any specific person, but, you know, you have helped build, design, you know, a lot of the who's who of Southern California and Hollywood. What's it like navigating the stars of the egos and those kind of things and all of the pressures that get put on outside of what I would call a normal project? Or is there one?
You know, wow. Oh, I don't know if I have enough time to answer that question. you know, I'm going to say that quite often it's easier. Because they compartmentalize really well. And nobody is better at knowing the proper roles of delegation than somebody who's been part of a successful operation. I will tell you that if you wonder why a certain star that you used to like is no longer acting when you thought they were really good, and you'll find out that they're not great on a set. A set is made of a team that if everybody's not on the same page, if you've got a diva actor, it makes everything more difficult. If you've got a grip who never shows up, they're gone. Everybody there is forced to learn to get along and be a part of a group. And so that makes it really easy. Do you know what the hardest part of dealing with clients is more than anything else?
What's
when
that?
You have a very successful, if you have a couple and one of them is very successful and always busy and always taking meetings and always making deals, and then you've got their partner sitting around at home having lunch with their friends, they then see this as an opportunity to really get involved. And they tend to overcomplicate things. They'll come into your office and dump a plastic bag full of white color chips, because you know how many shades of white there are, and just say, I just can't make up my mind. They all look good to me. Somebody who's really busy will say, I like that one, and just move on.
Yep.
Because I remember in architecture school, we had a conversation. When do you know you're done with the floor plan and you can move on? If you only work on the floor plan, you'll never be finished. But if you take the floor plan and start seeing how that looks in elevation and in the section of the building, you will make changes in the floor plan that are meaningful because they relate to something else that's important. If all you do is focus on one thing, you can never, ever finish making a decision. So so it's funny. I mean, I'm trying to think of this. I've dealt with a lot of very big people, and if they have an unbelievable ego, to be honest with you, I just won't take the job because the quality of the client, I never pick a job because, ooh, they're famous.
No, you've got lots of clients, and you and I have talked about a lot of the different names, but I mean, you've had a lot of great people, but at the same point, some of them are famous, some aren't. To me, you seem to be very project oriented, not people. As far as you know, what's the last name on the contract?
The thing that's really good about these people, sometimes these famous people, sometimes they've been given so many golden tickets that they kind of get the feeling, I want this. Is that possible? Mm-hmm. And most people, most of us live in a life where we're standing in line to pay for food at the grocery store. Okay.
Yep.
And they hire people to go grocery shopping for them, so they never have to worry about it. Mm-hmm. So those of us that get a little more used to standing in line, we can sometimes limit our own thinking. I mean, I did a house that has an Indiana Jones style rope bridge to take you to the game house. And there's not a lot of clients that would say, I'd like an Indiana Jones style rope bridge. I want a fireman's pole to go from the second floor down to the first just for fun.
Nobody you and I ever were talking says, about hey, doing that into my hot tub, putting a fire pole into my hot tub. And then hey, you came out with about 100 good ideas for that. So same kind of thing.
but so the point is, it's like, and if you say, okay, I get it, but you can convince them out of it if it's not a good idea. But if it's a good idea, why wouldn't you say, if that's good, can you imagine having a house and showing your friends around and say, oh, and there's the fireman's pole. Yeah. And people will go, what? Everybody's different. I remember I did a house in Beverly Hills. I was so young. And it was a remodeling, and we were rearranging the kitchen, and there were like, this was an old home in Beverly Hills, and we're adding a second floor and doing a remodeling on the first. And this client, she had bought this apothecary cabinet that we used as the island. Mm-hmm. And so it allowed us to move some walls. And when we moved the walls, we ended up with two pantries, a very close pantry, like that was the door was right there in the kitchen, and it was a normal size large pantry to put all your food stuff in. Mm-hmm. And then we were able to make another pantry that quite honestly was 7 by 14 feet, like the size of a lot of bedrooms. And we filled it with shelves. And this was a woman who entertained and threw parties of all kinds of sizes and all kinds of themes. And we filled it with chafing dishes and pots and places to put a tablecloth. And I am telling you, every time she would show the house to friends, and I would be over quite a bit, whether it be for dinner or just to kind of look at how things were going, or even in the middle of construction, she would show people around. She would take the other wives into this other closet pantry.
Nice.
And I swear 9 out of 10 would walk out of that room, look at their husband and say, if you loved me, you would give me a pantry like this to their husband. Awesome. Everybody's got something that is, and this was the greatest source of pride of this woman was her pantry, because it was something no one else had, and she saw a need for it, and she made it happen. And
she had
when this goes to, I hear a lot of people say, well, I'd like to do this, but it's not good for resale. And my answer, because I've done this so many times, is not true. Mm-hmm. Okay. If we didn't put it in, your house might be worth, you know, 2.5, and you'll list it at 2.7 because that's, you know, you want to have a place to bargain from. Mm-hmm. If somebody walks in and sees that thing that you love, that 9 out of 10 people don't care about, but 1 out of 10 person, they will walk in and they will look at it and say, oh, I don't care what it costs. I need this house.
Yep.
I've always wanted one of these. I got to have it.
Yep. And they're the king of the bidding war, because now it's all emotion.
There we go. And now they've said, you know what? Everybody's going to come in with an offer at 2.5. We'll make it we'll meet you. We'll even make it 2.75 because we want this.
Yep.
And now you're getting real value out of something that you enjoy. Oh my goodness. I remember I just read an article last week where Jay Leno had bought this house in, I think it was in Maine, right on the water. And he spent $12 million. He said, oh my God, $12 million. Well, it's 20 something thousand square feet. It was built 100 and something years ago. And a similar house in California, which is, you know, where he lives most of the time, mm-hmm. would be $40 million.
Yeah.
And there it was only 10, and it's where his family lives. He said, this is my philosophy in life is like, I own 700 cars. Okay. Some of them have gone up in value. I don't care. I buy what I love. And if it goes down in value, I don't care. I love it. It's me who's driving it. I'm not buying it to sell it. I'm buying it to use it. So you should get what you want.
You know, and that's the thing, you know, and especially if you look at real estate prices right now, you could do what you want to it, and it's still going to go up right now. I mean, you've been sharing on social media the last couple of weeks here stuff on the market down in your area, and sheesh, some of that stuff's crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, I complain about it in my area.
And again, it's all value. I actually brought up, oh my goodness, $1.25 million for a 90-year-old house that's only 600 square feet with no view, you know, on Topanga, which is this major artery that goes through the mountains from the valley in Los Angeles to basically Malibu.
That is a very busy, fast street.
Yeah. And so one person writes back, goes, you have no idea the value of Malibu. You can go from here, you can go from there. It's like, yeah, I agree. It's a lovely place, and it's very bohemian. It's right for some people, and if you love it, you love it. But we're talking about $1.25 million for 600 square feet. 600.
Yeah. And it's not a big enough lot to be able to do anything with that, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. And that was kind of my point. And so she's a friend. Okay, I won't mention any names. She's a friend. But she's like, no, Topanga's great. It's got all this hippie influence, and there's all this music that happened there, and you can go easily to the freeway, to the valley, and easily to the beach. Yeah, but it's 20 minutes in either direction to each one of those. And I'm not saying that it's not a pretty house. I'm not saying it's not in a lovely location. But that just seems like she would spend it. I wouldn't. Yeah. That's the way it goes. Everybody's different.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And everybody is different. And everybody sees the value of what they value. So you and I look at that and go, not a chance. There's always somebody out there that goes, oh, that's perfect. I want to be able to where I could just jump in my car and go.
You know, that's the reason why when you're in architecture school, they teach you how to be a modernist. Because it's too hard to learn the intricacies of classical design. If you're going to get into, do you put a dental or do you put a frieze? Is it Greek? Is it Roman? There's a difference between the two. How do you do it authentically? They're really important conversations, but most teachers at architecture school don't even know the answers to them. And so we all are trained in modernism because that's just sculpture. And I shouldn't say it's just sculpture. That's a terrible way to put it. But it gives the professors and the students a chance to debate the sculptural qualities of the forms without having to get into historical accuracy. And so when I then became a professional, the second job that I got was working for a person who did nothing but traditional because I hadn't learned it and I needed to know it. And I needed a palette because we're service professionals. If you're going to be spending, whether it be $100,000 or $10 million on a project, it's probably a lot of money to you no matter what. It's just your framework of what's a lot. And so if you want Amish, if you're spending the money to hire me to do Amish, I'm going to give you the best damned Amish that you could get for the price. And if you want French, if you want English, I'm going to be able to do that.
Yep.
So, you know, that just goes back. That goes back to what we were saying before about everybody's got a different point of view, and it's important to be able to have the tools to make those points of view come to life.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's funny. You and I are a lot of the same ways. When I was, 30 years ago, I had worked for Home Depot for a year because they basically gave me an offer. They were opening up all their stores here in the Northwest, and they had gave me an offer and a contract that said, we want you to work for us for a year to help get our kitchen design departments up and running. And I signed a one-year contract with them. And I worked exactly 1 year to the day.
I could just see you with your countdown calendar.
Oh, yeah. It was
15 days left.
Yep.
12 days.
Yeah. And no shade against those guys, but it wasn't my jam.
No.
More importantly, though, what was fun was I left that to go work in downtown Seattle at the highest end kitchen and bath design firm that I had ever worked for. and ever thought of working for. I mean, we were doing, back in the early 2000s, we were doing small kitchen cabinet packages for some 1930s home that the cabinet package was $100,000. And this was all, you know, just name brand Architectural Digest cabinet brands, if you know what I mean.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the William O's, the Valcachines, all those guys. And it was fun, but I wanted to put myself in that other situation that I had not learned. And that was where I jumped into that high-end design, and it was fun.
But look at you. You needed all of those hours of doing every kind of kitchen imaginable to then go to the big leagues and work on these super expensive ones and still make them work. Because it's amazing how many times we will see something like a bathroom or a kitchen. It's so funny how many times I'll go into a kitchen and I'll think, what would Eric say about this? Because there's so much wasted space.
Yep.
And so many ridiculous doodads that have nothing to do with actually cooking.
Yep.
And sometimes it's form over function, which is also bad. So you and I are both friends with the Blaze, Caroline Blazowski.
Oh, yeah.
And she's looking for a house. And so every now and then she'll get in touch with me. What do you think about this house? What do you think about this house? Yep. And it's hard because you look at that bathroom is such a waste of space.
Yep.
Oh, I can't believe what they did there. Or she's looking at one right now that it's like, this is a passive solar house. And so I look at the picture, she goes, oh, and David, it's passive solar. And I said, yeah, how?
How?
What about it is passive solar?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a greenhouse, but the greenhouse has a carpeted floor. It can't absorb the heat.
Yeah, what's it going to do?
The heat sink. Yeah. You know, there's sheetrock walls built with 2x4s or 2x6s. Maybe there's a lot of insulation, but there's no solar panels. I don't see any kind of mechanism to make sure that the breeze is going through in a way that creates a Venturi effect.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, people will use words,
yep,
but not follow through.
Very true. Very true. And, you know, shooting back here at my experience that I learned so much with, the one funny, and I'll just wrap up that thought real quick. I learned my best lesson because it happened to me. And it was a fairly famous celebrity. So somebody pulls up in this old early 50s pickup truck that has fairly original paint, you know.
Really?
If I remember right, there was a door on the side that was a different color, like it was a red truck with a yellow door.
Yeah.
Guy gets out in overalls, walks into our very, I mean, I'm wearing a suit, you know, it was a full-on suit wearing kind of place.
Can we stop for a moment?
Yep.
And imagine our good friend Eric G in a suit with a tie.
Yep. There we go.
Okay. I've had that moment. I hope everybody else has enjoyed that lovely trip down the imagination lane. Yep. Please continue.
So I'm in my suit and tie. He walks in and this other person goes, oh, you want to get the farmer? And I'm like, oh, I got it. No problem. Walks up. I'm like, Mr. Skerritt, what can I do to help you today? Thanks for coming in. It's Tom Skerritt.
Okay. My only comment is I pumped gas next to him once.
Nice. Wonderful
nice
man.
Guy.
Wonderful
really
man.
Nice guy.
Yep. Wonderful
man. Oh,
man.
I would have loved to have done his kitchen.
So I got to do his powder room. So that was fun. So got to do his powder room. We did a cool little glass vessel. Our team did. It was fun. So I did a lot of drawings of hand drafting of his powder room over and over again, but he was a great
the farmer's
guide
powder room.
Yep, the farmer's powder room. Farmer's so it was fun. It was a cool project. But that was one of those that that I learned to never. And again, I knew who it was coming in. I saw him. I was like, oh wow, this is weird. Everybody else, nobody else grabbed. You know, figured out who he was walking in. To me, I was like, ding, I know who that is. This is impressive. You know, and you just never judge that book by its cover because it's going to be shocking. And it ties back into your, where, you know, driving the Blazer up to the up to the mm-hmm. the client's house, you know. And now, it's same story.
I was actually very upset with her because I'm thinking, you should never judge a book by its cover. How dare you? I actually said that. I said, well, I'm a little hurt that you didn't, you know, that you didn't pay attention to my words and my ideas and my car colored it. And she said, David, I'm only telling you this because this is Los Angeles. And believe it or not, it matters. A contractor should probably show up in a beat up truck so that way the client thinks they really shaved their prices.
Yep.
Okay. They may drive a Cadillac at home.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But to the work, they bring a beat up truck. Says, but you as an architect, we've got to think that you're successful, that you make lots of money, that everybody wants you and everybody's paying top dollar. And the way that you do that is you drive a nice car. So I actually spent a week talking to all of my friends and they all eventually agreed with her. And the next day I bought a BMW 5 Series.
Yep.
Because I thought that might make a difference.
Sad that you have to do that.
I have no idea.
But I agree. I mean, I have, you know, I like cars. I'm you know, like Jay Leno does. I don't have 700 cars, but I love cars. And mm-hmm. I have been judged that way for driving too expensive of a car rolling up. And they go, oh, I'm not sure if we can afford you.
Right. I mean, but wouldn't you like to have that 1950s truck with the oddly colored door?
Yeah.
I would.
Nothing wrong with that.
The patina of the original paint? Oh, that would be phenomenal. I would love to have an old truck. Oh,
and his wife was driving a 10-year-old Volvo wagon.
You know, look, why do we live in such a throwaway society? I want to build the kind of house that nobody needs to remodel. I mean, you know, Eric knows me, and we've been talking about a house that I put an offer on, which is actually in the neighborhood. It is a mile and a half from the very first house I designed when I went on my own. Mm-hmm. Okay. And these clients are now in their 70s and we're in touch. They say there's nothing we want to change in the house. We love it just the way that it is. Just a little paint here. Maybe, you know, replace the refrigerator, the dishwasher, but change the cabinets a little bit in the kitchen, but they love it. This was a big time TV writer mm-hmm. who's what they call a showrunner. He produces and runs several shows that have been on network television. So he had, you know, a lot of money. And what they would do is when their kids were little, when I first did, it's so funny, their kids are almost 40, but but they were tiny little kids when mm-hmm. When we were first working together, and they would once a month go to the Bel Air Hotel and have a weekend, a romantic weekend, just the two of them, okay, and have their parents, one of their sets of parents, you know, come and stay in the house and take care of the kids. Nice. When we finished the design, they made the kids go to their grandparents' house, and they just stayed. The guy said, you are saving me thousands of dollars a month because we're just staying at the home and just ordering in the most expensive food. You know, and just in lighting candles and having a very romantic time in the house. I mean, that is the compliment. You know, that is what you want your clients to be enjoying.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny. I've looked at some of your places, you know, like this last year, you know, Elon Musk's house that he sold made the news because he was getting out of California. And that was a house that you originally had done the design work on, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. And those projects have been remarkably timeless. I mean, stunning work, man. And I just, not saying that as your friend, but just professionally beautiful stuff that with maintenance, you can't tell when that building was built because it just has that classic architecture to it that's beautiful and makes sense and is balanced where it needs to be.
Well, and what's so funny is the pictures that you've been looking at recently, because I've been revisiting three different jobs that I did as long as 30 years ago and as recently as 15 years ago. And one is modern and two are traditional. One's more Italian and one's more English. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to think that each one of them, and I think they are, I just don't want to be arrogant about it because I'm always trying to get better. I hope they're timeless. I had a professor in architecture school who we did a project and it was all over with. I was walking out and he saw me and said, "Why are you looking so glum?" And I said, "Oh, now that we did the presentation, I should have moved the door here. I could have made this part a little bit taller." And he looked at me and he said, "David, it's called the practice of architecture because you never get it right. You just get closer to perfection each time with what you learn." Which, of course, then, again, that goes back to what this started out as. That's why you hire an architect. Or that's why you hire a good architect. Hire a good architect who is not going to make you one of 50 projects that he's rushing through. But look, my practice, when my ex-wife, you know, became pregnant, I had just had a conversation with Frank Gehry about a mutual friend of ours who had passed away at 50. Wow. And he said, "You know, this is how architecture works. When you're 20, you work for slave wages. And when you're in your 30s, you then start making a little bit more money, but you're still, you're a peon. And then if you're lucky in your 40s, you go out on your own and you go back to making no money at all. And at your 50s is when you start realizing who you are and what your statements can be. You start getting really good at it. Mm-hmm. And it's your 60s are when you start getting busy." And he said, our friend, whose name was Frank, said he was 50. He was just getting to the point where we were going to see how good he really could be. And we lost him. So I was kind of in that same situation in that, you know, I was now in my 30s and I went on my own earlier, but I had trouble. I like being my own boss. So I had an opportunity and I took it and, you know, I was working and I was doing what you normally do. You work on your own, you work on the side while you got a job and then you work on your own. And then if you're lucky, you get enough work that you can hire another person to help you. And if you get more work, then you hire two more people until you end up with a pretty decently sized office. Well, I had four employees and some interesting things happened. I had one employee totally messed up and had to get rid of her. And then it was like, oh my goodness. And then I started doing more of the work myself. Instead of delegating, I had to fix what was wrong. And I had so much fun. And then all of a sudden, like I said, we became pregnant as a family. And I thought, I really want to be there more. So I did the opposite. I made my office smaller. I only had one person. I took on half as much work.
And made more money.
Really good clients.
Yeah.
And I had more fun. And yes, believe it or not, I made more money because I was actually paying myself as the boss and as one of the employees. It's still, you know, I make less money than either of my brothers and a lot of my friends that I went to college with. But that's okay because my brother who makes the most money, it's all mergers and acquisitions. It's all numbers. How much is this worth in the company? How much is that worth in the company? When you and I are done, we actually build something.
Yeah, there's something to show for it. Something physical that's there for, you know, maybe generations.
Yeah, I've got kids doing homework on the, you know, on the bar counter while mom is cooking dinner. And that gives me a great amount of joy that this kid is being nurtured in something that I created to make that person as comfortable and receptive to good things as possible.
Amazing. It looks like you've got a couple projects that are just coming out of the ground or at least going to start moving dirt on here pretty quick. It looks like things are cruising again for you.
Thank God. You know, COVID, it's amazing that my project in Houston, believe it or not, Houston had the best COVID protocol. Put that together. It's a protocol.
Yep.
Houston had because they were wanting to go online years before. And so they started working in that direction. Mm-hmm. And so they were ready to do things online and they just sped it up a little bit. Beverly Hills, you have to use Flash, which isn't even available anymore to utilize their portal. And that makes it very difficult. So I've had a couple of projects that just the permit process, the poor clients are just pulling their hair out because you have to be so patient. My job in Beverly Hills, again, not that big. Should have taken 3 months, 6 months at the most to get a permit. It took 11.
Wow.
But we got it. We got it. Now, I got it on Thursday. I still haven't been given a price. I'm checking my computer right now, but I haven't gotten the price for the permit so that we can then utilize. Nope, still haven't gotten it.
Wow.
Still haven't gotten it. And the client, like, calls. Have you had your meeting yet? Nope. But, yeah. So, anyway, got two permits and a supplemental permit on another one to make a slight change, and they're all greenlit. So
nice.
We'll do – to me, I mean, I love designing, but I love the building process. I love watching it because it all starts as an idea on a blank piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're done, you've got something you walk into and you feel something. And then you go from room to room and you're fed or you sleep or you go to the bathroom or have a drink or whatever. And it's like magic. I don't know how to describe how content it makes one feel to have, to have your client walk around with you and then you just see their eyes filled with tears of joy that they're moving into this dream come true. Oh, it's the best.
Amen, brother. Amen. I mean, that's the part that I used to love the most is you get through the whole process and I would go, they'd get moved into the kitchen or they'd get moved into the house of what they're doing. And I'd go in there a couple weeks later and kind of just do a walkthrough with them. And after they moved in, after the dust has settled. And that was always the funnest part of the entire project for me was seeing them use it. And then naturally them talking about the things that they loved the most. And they were maybe not the things that I thought they would love the most.
Right. Yeah, isn't it amazing how, like, 2 weeks later, they'll say, you know what I realized about this house?
Yep.
When you wake up in the morning and you wash your face and you turn to get a towel, you put this window where I can see the tops of the mountains and the sun coming up. And it makes me think, today is a new day to do something brilliant. Mm-hmm. I never thought they would do that.
Of course not.
But, boy, did it make them happy.
And that's why... You know, you and I have both loved what we've been doing for so long, and that's the art of design right there.
Mm-hmm. It's funny. You don't think about it. We think that we're in the building business, but we're really in the people business. It's one of the reasons why I do it if it's special, but I don't prefer to do commercial because to me, commercial is let's see how many eggs we can fit in this crate. You know, let's make
and
all
for
these
this
little
low
cubicles.
Of price.
Yeah, they don't care. Like the thing I don't like about a high rise is, yes, you fit a lot of office space per square foot of land, but where's the human interaction? Where is the inspiration to do a better job? Where is a place to make sure that somebody that one of your employees that you're planting that seed in them grows? It isn't really celebrated in a commercial space, the way that it is in a home. Now, I've done several record companies because that's a place where they are interested in the human experience.
Yep.
Okay. When I did Quincy Jones's offices, he looked at me and he said, because we were talking about needs and this, he said, there's only one thing I need. You must put a piano somewhere in this space. Because every year, he says, I have a deal with Ray Charles that we sign a contract every year. It's always a one-year deal. Mm-hmm. And because Ray was like his first friend in the music business.
Yep.
He said, so when Ray comes in to sign the contract, we jam. And he sits at the piano and spends at least an hour playing for all of us. And I cannot not let that happen. So that became the center of the entire experience. Was Ray Charles, I mean, it was empty most of the time,
yeah.
But everybody knew sometime within the next year, Ray Charles was coming in and he was going to play.
Fun fact, one of my little brothers played with Ray Charles on his last, played saxophone for Ray Charles on his last tour.
Ooh.
Up and down the East Coast. So, yeah, love
that
Ray Charles.
That is special.
Yeah.
That is special. Yeah, I got to hear him play once, and it was, you know, that's, we all love music, we all love live music, and we all love our stars, but man, when you are that up close and personal, and when he's chit-chatting, you know, and especially when when Q is saying, why don't you play that in the key of E instead?
Nice.
And they look at each other, and they smirk, and then they play, and it's magic.
Yeah.
And it's great.
Yeah, I've had a few musician things like that from legends before, you know. Buddy Guy ended up at his blues club one night and got to meet him. And it was just a Wednesday night in Chicago, and he ended up sitting at the table with us, ordering drinks, popping up on stage, playing, coming back down, and got to really spend some time with that guy and talk
what
about
a guy
another.
To talk to.
Oh, amazing human. Amazing human. You know, and then it was just one of those moments that, and then every time he comes to town, I've gotten to know his keyboard player. And so whenever he comes to Portland, I try to meet up there, and we've met up and went out for drinks afterwards, or we'll meet up someplace. And it's just fun stuff. And I just love that classic, you know,
yeah,
American musician that has made such a mark on so many millions of people.
And see, here's the thing that you and I and most of the people that are listening have a chance to do, which is create something that becomes your own stage, becomes your own ability to do what you love to do in your life.
Yeah.
Or at least it should be. Everybody's home. There should be something in the home that gives them rest. There should be some place in the home that gives them inspiration. Mm-hmm. And there should be some place that gives them comfort, and in some place it gives them nourishment. And
absolutely,
when you meet all of those, you're creating a home. You're not building a house. You're creating a home.
Exactly. On that note, David Applebaum, thanks for coming on today. We're running out of time.
Are we done already?
Yeah, it's been an hour, man. We've been killing it.
Did we talk about anything important or informative?
We always do.
I hope so.
I hope we did. Thanks for coming on today, my friend.
Dude, it is always a treat to talk to you. You are a kindred spirit. You are the kind of guy who really wants the whole world to be in a better place. And you've figured out a way to do that. And love, I mean, you're so good at what you do. You give so much information. You make it so easy to consume. And so fun. And to be a part of that in even a little way is such an honor. And you,
brother,
being a friend is an honor too.
Same here,
thank
man.
You.
Same here. I love what you're doing. I love hanging out. And as everybody else knows out there, if they see on my social stuff, we're chatting all the time. All the time. All right,
yeah,
brother.
Don't take a lot of what we say to each other seriously, though, everybody.
No,
we know
not
each other
too
long
seriously.
Enough. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's a little
yeah.
snark in a lot of our comments back and forth, rightfully so, because we're having a good
yeah,
time.
Yeah, a little. Yeah, let's leave it at a little.
All right, brother, have a great day. Thanks again.
Thank you. Okay, goodbye, everybody. Hey, go out there and make it a good day, okay?
Man, Dane, that could have been a two-hour conversation, and we were headed that way, and I had to tap the brakes.
I mean, hey, we took some of it out, so make sure to listen to it on the podcast.
Absolutely. About 20 minutes of that, 25 minutes of that, you missed. We're out of time. I'm Eric G.
I'm Dane Vodder.
And you've been listening
to Around the House.
Around the House with Eric G. is produced by Designed by Eric G. in association with Salem Media and distributed nationally by the Sun Broadcast Group. All rights reserved. Copyright Designed by Eric G. We will be back next week. If you missed part of the show, check out the podcast of all of our shows at AroundTheHouseOnline.com. Remember, measure with a micrometer, mark with caulk, and cut with an axe. Thanks for listening to Around the House.
Hey, it's Eric G. from Around the House. Are you planning a decking or siding project this year? If you are, you've got to check out my friends at Millboard. Millboard is a completely different kind of composite decking and cladding that enhances outdoor spaces with enduring distinction. Hand-molded from the finest oak,
It realistically mimics the natural grain and color of premium hardwood. If you're looking for something that doesn't look like plastic and instead real wood, check out Millboard.com. Make sure and check out that interview we did just a few weeks back. That's Millboard.com.